Wow, thank you so much. What a pleasure it is to be here. We get to talk about Jesus. Let me tell you about my Jesus, one of my favorite songs. The other morning I got up and I started playing it before I had my first cup of coffee, and I almost didn't need caffeine after listening to Let Me Tell You About My Jesus. So, yeah, you can put up the first slide there so we can kind of dive into this. I'm wearing the same shirt. Sweetie, I got to get another shirt. So this is just amazing to me what everybody's dealing with, whether it's a family or an individual, an uncle, an aunt, a brother, sister, grandmas, grandpas. It's a big deal. And I think we've taken our eyes off of Jesus. And when we take our eyes off of Jesus, we stumble. I took my eyes off of Jesus. And I stumbled. But let's talk a little bit about what happened, what I would assert that caused this end result. That journey started, believe it or not, in 1944 for me. I was born in 1940. In 1944, my dad and my mom were avid fishermen, living in LA, and they would drive up to the mountains and go fishing at a lake. And Dad would drive me over to my mother's house, my grandmother's house, and drop me off at Grandma's. And she lived behind a junkyard of cars. And my grandpa, her husband, was a tow truck driver, and that was where they lived, near where he did his tow truck driving. And it was a rundown old shack that would be out of place and ramshackled even in Tijuana today. It was really a desperate house. But Grandma, she was a robust lady. She always wore an apron, always had a cigarette in her mouth, and a half pint of whiskey in her apron pocket. She loved her whiskey, and so did Grandpa. Grandpa, who only had one leg because at 16 he fell off a train, trying to hop a train in a town in Texas where he lived, and the train ran over his leg and cut his leg off. And so Grandma, to make money, was a seamstress and would make women's clothing. And I can't explain every little detail about how it happened, but at some point in time, during the many times I was at my grandma's at 4 years old, I started cross-dressing in her clothing in the big closet she had. And I know I'd spent a lot of time leaning on her sewing machine, kind of watching her make clothing, as a four-year-old might do, out of curiosity. And so she began to see that as an opportunity to make me my own little purple chiffon dress. And so she had a little stool about this big and round. She'd have me stand on it, and she would start forming this purple chiffon evening dress just for me. And frankly, it seemed kind of exciting. I was getting attention. Who doesn't love attention? Because it felt, at the time, it felt like she was loving on me. It felt like love and attention. But it's instructive for us today to ask the question, what does a four-year-old know about consequences? What does a four-year-old know about the fact that their little brain isn't fully developed, ladies and gentlemen, until they're 24 or 25? 24 or 25. The brain in a four-year-old is like this big sponge, taking in everything around it, all the senses, all the things that are happening, and trying to process it. And it shapes who they are. When I was four in 1944, I did not know that at 81, I would be standing up here talking to you folks this morning about how important it is to not put a four-year-old boy in a dress, because it has consequences. The consequences, as I realized today, was putting me in that dress, no matter how wonderful it seemed at the time, no matter how benign that it seemed, no matter how fun that it seemed, was emotional and psychological child abuse. We need to understand that. When we're advocating, supporting, encouraging, and giving opportunities to enable young people at 4 years old, 5 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old, 18 years, before they're fully developed, I might say, and understanding consequences and all the other things that are going on, it's child abuse. And so what happened was that I became so accustomed and so excited about that purple dress, I was actually looking forward to going to grandma's and letting her babysit me. That's part of the word that people don't like us to use, who push back against this. It's an indoctrination. Not a fun word, but it's an indoctrination to encourage and propel somebody in a direction that is opposite of who they are. Can you imagine, would I be standing here today if Grandma would have done the same kind of affirmation toward me as a little boy, taking me to the store and buying me blue jeans and cowboy boots, encouraging me as a boy, telling me how wonderful I was as a boy, how handsome I was as a boy, anything as a boy? That was void. Caused me to wonder what was wrong with me as a boy. I was able to understand that much at four, that there was this moment where you realize there must be something wrong with me. You see, there's a message in putting a four-year-old in a dress. And the only way you're going to be accepted by grandma and loved on and affirmed and encouraged is if I'm wearing a purple dress. That's child abuse, because it's not real. And so what happened after that, I got so excited about that purple dress after about 2 years. Oh, and by the way, Grandma said, this is our little secret. Don't tell your mom and dad. You know why we keep secrets? Because there's something wrong with what we're doing. We're ashamed of what we're doing. There's something bad going to happen if the truth gets out. Today we're going to talk about the truth so that good things can happen. That's what I want for four-year-olds. I don't want four-year-olds being dressed in different clothing and told they can be something different, because you'll see as we go on this morning that much of that's not true. So I took the purple dress home in a brown paper bag so Dad couldn't see it, and put it in my bottom dresser drawer, and thinking that I could put it on and begin to feel that same feeling that I got when Grandma was affirming me as a girl. But my mom found the dress when she was putting clothes away. And she confronted me one night at the dinner table and asked me where the dress came from. And I said, well, Grandma made it. Now, my dad was sitting there. The old mother-in-law story really blossomed at that moment. He was not happy with his mother-in-law and what she had done to his little boy. He went ballistic. And they got in a huge fight. Now, I felt responsible for the fight because I was supposed to keep the secret, and I didn't keep the secret. So now that's my fault, that they're fighting. If I had just kept the secret, they wouldn't be fighting. The purple dress disappeared. I never saw it again. I never got to go back to Grandma's house without my mom and dad being with me because it wasn't safe. My dad, who was a fantastic guy, was a part-time police officer, muscular, bright, intelligent, traveling salesman, great guy, loved him. But he was scared to death of what was happening. And so he began to, in his own mind, look at me like a blacksmith looks at a hunk of iron. If I'm going to shape this iron, I've got to put it in the fire and heat it up so it's malleable and I can pound on it. Well, he started pounding on me with a hardwood floor plank when I did something wrong. That was the consequence of Grandma making me a purple dress. No purple dress, no hardwood floor plank. Further down the road, you see my dad's adopted brother, Uncle Fred, found out about me wearing a purple dress, and Uncle Fred, who was not the brightest bulb in the chandelier, drank a little bit himself, decided to, by this time I'm 8 or 9 years old, began sexually molesting me. Now, when I told my parents what Uncle Fred was doing, they said, well, you're a liar. Uncle Fred would never do that. So I realized I couldn't tell anybody anything that was truthful because they weren't going to believe me. So I internalized all this stuff at 8 or 9. Purple dress, hardwood floor plank, sexual abuse at 9 years old. There are no words in the 40s about transgenderism, transitioning, or any of that stuff. I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew that I couldn't go to sleep at night for at least an hour thinking about, what am I going to be like? Am I going to be a woman? Am I going to be a man? What's going to happen? Am I going to be abused? That was my 9-year-old life. By 13, I was beginning to secretly identify as Crystal West. Now, nobody knew. I just internalized that, and I called myself Crystal West as a coping mechanism for cross-dressing, hardwood floor plank, and sexual abuse. But how do I know that? You say that sexual abuse would not have occurred had it not been for the purple dress. Do we understand that? I think it's just, I want to stay with that. Because if we don't understand the consequences, we're not going to stop and understand the abuse that we're putting children through and calling it something else. I mean, they love to rename things. And so what happened was I grew up and went through school. I ran on track. I played football. But I had this purple dress living in my head 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There was something wrong with me because of the first several years of my life. And so I eventually started going to junior college. I failed out of junior college because I had a difficult time studying and maintaining a good attention span. I was going to church, and I met a girl, Sue, who became my first wife. I was never homosexual. 90% of the thousands of individuals that have contacted me that I've worked with who have identified men who've identified as women are heterosexual. Too many times we think automatically they must be homosexual. It's not. It's an identity issue. An identity issue caused by a purple dress or a hardwood floor plank or sexual abuse or something else. So I was married. I had two children. I was going to school and studying as hard as I could. I really had this great desire to be hugely successful. I had a friend in high school and all the way through my early life whose dad was a multimillionaire. And he was, at his 16th birthday, he was given $2 million. And so I wanted to aspire to, and I told him on his 16th birthday, I said, I am going to be so rich, Ken, someday you're going to have to come to me to borrow money. Because I thought I was going to be richer than anybody. So I studied. And I started working in the aerospace industry at Libroscope and worked on the Polaris missile. I went from there and I became an associate design engineer on the Apollo space missions in the area of cryogenics. I went from there to the automobile industry and I became the national operations manager for American Honda Motor Company. I had two parking places, tremendous paychecks, unlimited expense account. I was living the high life. I had a purple dress, hardwood floor plank, and sexual abuse still troubling me, had not been resolved. Struggling with these issues, I took to using alcohol and cocaine while I was successful. Too much cocaine and too much alcohol. I was struggling to cope with the consequences of what had happened to me years earlier. Who's going to help me with this? Was it going to be alcohol? Was it going to be cocaine? No. Eventually, I went to one of those people who was a specialist in this stuff they call transitioning and gender dysphoria. Well, this guy was the super specialist. He wrote the standards of care, WPATH standards of care. He made the first draft of those standards. His name was Dr. Paul Walker. He had an office in Union Street in San Francisco. I was a wealthy guy at the time. I wasn't rich enough to loan Ken, my friend, money, but I was doing well. And so I could afford to go see Walker at his office. And he told me that I had gender dysphoria or gender identity disorder and that you need hormones and you need to go through surgery to resolve these things. And I said, yeah, but I was hit with a hardwood floor plank and I was sexually, no, it doesn't matter. The resolve for this is cutting off body parts and filling yourself with hormones and changing your identity. That is the only way that you're going to get over this. Now, as an associate design engineer at one time, and now I'm an executive for a car company, I'm supposed to be a smart guy. And at the time, I listened to him explain this to me. And I couldn't totally make sense of it, but there was no Walt Heyer voice yelling at the time, the bridge is out. The bridge is out. Don't go down this road. There was nobody out there. That's why I'm here today. Ladies and gentlemen, the bridge is out. But I took his advice. I followed, I'm married. He knew that. I followed the protocols, took hormones for 2 years. I went to him a few times in between getting his approval. And then at the end of 2 years, I went back and said, are you sure this is the right thing to do? This is like 1983. And he wrote me a second letter of approval for surgery and all that stuff. I divorced my wife. I left my children, my son and my daughter, both in their teens, because of a purple dress, a hardwood floor plank, and being sexually abused. And because now, in the midst of this, we have somebody that says, you need to cut your genitals off. You need to fill yourself with hormones. And you need to change who you look like. So, what you see there is not God's plan in the red dress, in the red sweater. That's man's design. A cosmetic appearance. You see the difference? When the sperm hits the egg, our gender and sex are fixed and unchangeable at that moment. You can't unwind it. The only thing they can do is change what you look like. Let me tell you something. Laura, in that picture, has not changed genders. That is not a gender change. That is not even a transgender. That isn't even a transition. It's a man cosmetically made by doctors, hormones, and needless surgeries that are so destructive that the people who go through the process, according to Sweden, are 19 times more likely to commit suicide than if you don't do it. Does that startle you? That we're approving and affirming and guiding and nurturing people towards something that's causing them to commit suicide at a rate 19 times greater than if they didn't? I'm shocked. I tried to commit suicide. At the time, I said, I'm such a mess. The Lord doesn't even want me up there. So he saved my life. I tried to commit suicide by overdosing on cocaine. Didn't work. Well, you can see it didn't work, yeah. That's fairly obvious. So here's the question that we're all wondering about. Do you change genders? The answer is no. And let me tell you, next slide. We're fixed at conception. You know, they use a term, what gender were you assigned at birth? Well, that's a total farce. No one in this room or any place on the planet has ever had their gender and sex assigned at birth. It's done at conception 9 months before you're born. They like to say that. And let me tell you why they say it. Because if they can convince you that your gender and sex were assigned at birth, then they can change it after. That's why they say it. Not because it's true, it's because that makes it something that they can change. It's false. Next slide. Okay. When I went through this and I started studying psychology at UC Santa Cruz, because I wanted to, at the time, I really wanted to help other people, quote, transition, because that's how deluded I was. I started studying psychology in a PhD class. I wasn't a PhD. Anybody could get in the class. It was filled mostly with PhDs. I wanted to know the pharmacology. I wanted to know about addictions. I wanted to know about all these things. And the first thing I studied was, I went in the stack of books and I looked at a book and there was a study about a young boy who was changing, quote, his gender so that he could identify as a female. And in this study they did, it showed that he did it to keep his mother alive. What? Does that make sense? It's called separation anxiety. He took on his mother's identity because his mother had passed away, and his idea of keeping his mother alive was actually to become his mother. I looked at that and I went, okay, there's a lot of psychological things going on with this. And I decided in looking through these things, I realized that there's a thing called comorbidities. You know, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, dissociative disorder, that are, many of these things are caused by child abuse, by physical abuse. I suffered both of them. The emotional abuse of someone telling you you're not who you are. Today, the term is called adverse childhood experiences. I've written a lot and talked a lot about that. They're called ACEs, if you want to look it up. It's something we should all learn about. But here's the thing. I challenged my surgeon and the guy who approved me in court because I wanted to restore, by 1990, I was ready to restore, after 8 years of living as a female, restore my male gender identity and my male name. So I asked them, because I'd been turned down several times to do this in California, they wouldn't let me without some kind of real powerful doctor's document. So I asked the surgeon, I said, prepare a document that I can take to court that you and Walker can sign that will show them what you did. And so this is a court document that's on file in California, San Mateo Superior Court. You can look through that and it says, okay, what, taking hormones and having all the surgeries, what does it change? Your genetic sex, not changed. That's the first thing we should understand. The surgeon who does the surgery, who wrote an affidavit saying he changed my gender, actually lied on the affidavit because you can't change your genetic sex with hormones and surgery. No one in history has ever changed their gender sex with hormones and surgery. Let that sink in. I'm not saying this. This is a court document. The surgeon had performed 5,000, not one, 5,000 surgeries. Hormonal sex, neuter, that's because body parts are gone. Internal morphology, that really is who you are, is still male. That didn't change. External morphology, well, it was mixed. I had taken hormones for many years, and so I looked a little bit feminine because it does change your appearance. Gonadal sex was neutered because they had removed body parts. Those are consequences, by the way. When we talk about a boy cross-dressing at 4, these are consequences. I don't want us to miss that. Social sex is just what you present. Psychological sex is male. At the time, my legal sex was female. Now, does that, I mean, when you look at this, go, wait a minute. Nothing about me is female, but my legal sex is female. That's how, when they get started changing birth records, how they completely have destroyed this whole identity of who we really are. It's a sad tale. Next slide. So, when we understand, we talk about God's design today. God designed me to be a man. He didn't design me to lay down on a table and have a surgeon cut me up like a sushi chef and just destroy a body. This body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. I defiled it. I'm ashamed of that. For you were bought with a price. So glorify God with your body. You see, today, I get up every day, I want to glorify God. That's what my body, I want to present to you. And glorify God, all of us need to understand that cutting off body parts, filling ourselves with hormones, giving ourselves some new identity, does not glorify God. We took our eyes off of Jesus. Next slide. So today, this is sort of my way of trying to present what Romans 12:2 says. Because we're talking about, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That means learning something and understanding something. The truth is so important. That's what this is about. Then, when you learn the truth, as I did, then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. You see, the Lord got me to where a point where all I want to do is glorify God, because I want you to know and see firsthand this 81-year-old man who's been through all the things I've been through. I love the Lord Jesus. He loves me. He loves all of you. And no matter how many mistakes you've made, you can be redeemed and restored and glorify God. Don't you want to glorify God? Huh? Next slide. The other main core issue of me speaking is I'm going to tell you the truth so that I don't cause someone else to stumble and do what I did. That's all. I'm not trying to hurt anybody. If you saw someone about to stumble, would you want to prevent them from it? Would you want to give them information so that they don't harm themselves? You see, what I did when I divorced my wife, my daughter, who I love very much, we just saw 2 weeks ago, didn't speak to me for 8 years because I betrayed her. I betrayed her. The deepest hurt, my website, sexchangeregret.com. That sex change regret doesn't come because I regret what I did as much as what I did to my two children. See, there were consequences. From that purple dress, my kids suffered because no one was speaking out. There was no Walt voice saying, the bridge is out. Don't do this. No one pointed out that no one in history has ever changed their gender. You can change your appearance all day long. You can fill yourself with hormones. You can change your name. You can change, oh, yes, what is it, gender fluid and all these other different things. Every time someone makes an announcement that they're gender this or gender that and claim that they don't have a fixed gender, they're actually asserting when they make that statement that they have a fixed gender. You know, non-binary? They're saying they're non-binary. Well, then you're saying that your non-binary is actually saying that your binary, non-binary is fixed. You see how crazy it is? Does it make your head spin? It does mine. And so The next slide. Redemption and restoration. You see, that's the key. I went through all these things. I was an alcoholic, a drug addict. I went to a church, and my psychologist at the time, Dr. Dennis Guernsey, was a friend of the pastor at the church, and he says, I'll give him a call, because I wanted to go to church as Laura, and I'll give him a call, and you'll be welcome there, because I know this man. And so I went to that church as Laura one Sunday, sat down. Well, I went in and I filled out the welcome book, put my address and all that down, Laura, and the women surrounded me. I sat in the middle of the church, surrounded by the women. One of them was the pastor's wife, and listened to the message that day, and got up and they had donuts and coffee. And so I had donuts and coffee after church, and I thought, wow, this is cool. I've been accepted. I can rock and roll as Laura in church. Man, all right? I went home, and then mid-afternoon, I saw the pastor out the front window who had just given the message walking down my walkway. Knocked on the door, and I opened the door up. He took two steps in, and he said, we don't want your kind in our church. I got a big smile on my face, and I said, really? Tell me, pastor, what kind do you want in your church? He had no answer. You see, the church is a place for broken people, for broken ideas, for broken lives. Why? Because the church is a place for redemption and restoration. So I went to another church, but this time I didn't go to the Sunday service first. I went on a Wednesday to meet the pastor, Pastor Jeff Farrar. His brother Steve Farrar was a great author, wrote Point Man and several other books, was his brother. And Jeff was sitting behind his desk, and I went in and I said, well, I went to this other church, it's Laura, and they said they didn't want my kind there. I just want to know what you're going to do if I'm in the church. And he's playing with a pencil. I'll never forget it. And he had this big chair because he's a big guy. And he was rolling back, and I thought, oh, he's going to fall out of his chair. This guy's a little nuts. He actually seemed a little wacko, you know, but lovingly wacko. And so he's spinning a pencil, and he goes, well, let me tell you. He says, my job as a pastor is just to love you. But he said, don't be surprised if God doesn't change you. It stuck with me. And Jeff, to his credit, spent a lot of time with me. He'd take me to breakfast and lunch and dinner. He got a group of people to support me because I had no money. And he had me start writing a prayer letter that I wrote every week so people could pray for the things I needed. And people were leaving me money, $20, $30, whatever. I was broke. I was living on a couch. And I was trying to come back, right? And so I finally got to this point where I was dismissing my whole female identity, and I was walking toward through counseling. I was in therapy with two counselors. And so I went to this one Christian counseling center. I met with a guy for 3 hours on one Saturday. And I had 20-some pages of yellow-lined paper. I love yellow-lined paper. My wife hates it because when I write it, then she goes, what are you writing? It looks like hen scratching. I can't read what you're writing. But I wrote it all out. And I sat before him doing this session on one Saturday, going through all the things that had happened, the hardwood floor plank, the purple dress, you name it, I went through it. Sexual abuse. And it was a way that we do in recovery. I have 36 years clean and sober, by the way, from drugs and alcohol. Clean and sober. I do have a slight addiction to caffeine, however. But so I went through that with him, and we sat there, and he began through this process. He talked about everything that I went through. And when we were done with this yellow lined paper, and he says, you know, we need to go outside. And I didn't know what we were doing. And we went outside downstairs, went out in the parking lot. And he had a match. And he put a match to that yellow line paper and it started burning. And I'm watching this yellow line paper start to burn. And he kept holding it. And it's getting, the flame is getting bigger and bigger. And a breeze started to come. And as it totally burned up the yellow line paper, the breeze just took away the ashes in the parking lot and disappeared. And he says, "Okay, Walt," he said, "we're going to go back and pray. I got a confession to make. This guy is one of those people that will pray for like 2 hours. And this is my confession. I'm a 30-second wonder. And so don't judge me. I know there's one or two of you out there. But I decided that I would go and sit and let go through the prayer with him because he had given me so much of his time. But I was thinking, it's going to go past dinner. I'm not going to be happy about it, but I'll go. So I went up there. We sat down. He was across from me. I was here. He started praying. And he was praying. And at first I'm going, okay, how long is he going to go? I wasn't into it. I was already gone through the 3 hours and the burning of the paper, and I just couldn't quite connect with the prayer. But there was a moment where I didn't hear him. It was like he wasn't there. It was blank. And I looked up, and I saw the Lord Jesus Christ. And the Lord was coming down toward me. He was in white, coming down. I looked at where he was going. And I did the look, and there was a little baby that he was going for. A little baby. And I looked at the baby and I go, that baby's me. The Lord is coming for me. Not where I was that day. He was coming for me when I was a baby, before it all happened. He picked up that baby, held that baby in his arms, and looked at me, and he said, "You will be safe with me forever." And he disappeared. I realized at that moment that the Lord came to redeem my entire life. All the broken pieces. Every last broken piece. He had it all. He had pulled me back from everything. He had redeemed and restored my life, so that I could come and stand before you today to honor and glorify Jesus Christ, telling you the truth about what this is all about, so that you can go honor and glorify Jesus Christ. Thank you very much.